Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is The 100 Years War on Palestine, an afternoon with Rashid Khalidi. Professor Khalidi is a Palestinian-American historian of the Middle East and the Edward Said Professor Emeritus of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. The event was recorded on March 29, 2026, at the First Unitarian Congregational Society of Brooklyn and was co-sponsored by First Unitarian Brooklyn's chapter of Unitarian Universalists for Justice in the Middle East, New York City DSA Anti-War Working Group, and Brooklyn for Peace. The talk is a conversation between Professor Khalidi and Reverend Megan Henry from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Shelter Rock, followed by a Q&A session. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
I recently listened to your lecture at the American University of Cairo, mm-hmm. I think it was. And you did something there that I thought was so brilliant. I was wondering if you could maybe do that again here. You introduced the topic mm-hmm. of Palestine through kind of breaking down the title of mm-hmm. your book and mm-hmm. sharing a little bit about that and why you titled it very specifically and intentionally the way you did. I was wondering if you would be willing to do that.
Right. There are a few books that I think the title tells you all you need to know about the book. It's better to read the book after reading the title, obviously, but a good title encompasses what you're trying to say in the book. And there are very few books like that. And so with the title of this book, which is The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, I was trying to sum up some of the main themes of the book. There's a huge fallacy that the struggle in Palestine goes back since time immemorial. It doesn't. It really started in the 20th century. 1917 is the date I started with, but it's a very recent conflict. Another fallacy has it that this is a conflict essentially between two national movements, and that's all it is. So you have Zionism in Israel, and you have the Palestinians, or Arabs. And obviously that national conflict is part of it, but the missing aspect is the enormous role played by the great powers. You would not have the conflict we have today without Britain. You would not have the wars we have today without the United States. Mm-hmm. They're not external to this. They are part of these wars. In fact, there are phases in which Britain actually does the fighting during the whole period of the Mandate up to World War II. It was British troops who were putting in place the Zionist project by crushing the Palestinians. And so what I'm arguing with the first part of the title is this is not a war in Palestine or between Palestinians and Israelis only. It's a war on Palestine to establish this new entity, a Jewish state, in an overwhelmingly Arab country. And the British are central to that, and other powers, United States, Soviet Union, Britain, France, but especially last few decades, the United States, are central to it. This does not exist in the form it exists without those external actors. Without the Balfour Declaration, without the Mandate for Palestine, without the Partition Resolution, which are things done by foreign actors. Arabs and Jews have actually nothing to do with them. Without those things, you don't have this war, this conflict. So that's the first thing I was trying to show. The second thing I was trying to show through the title was that even though it's a national conflict, even though there's a religious aspect, even though Zionism was created to save Jews persecuted by anti-Semitic European countries, it also has another aspect, which is it is a settler colonial project. And I show that in the book by quoting every Zionist leader up through the 30s and 40s who freely admitted, yes, we have a claim to this land, but we are here as European settlers. This is a colonial project. I quote them at length in the book. And as with every settler colonial project, including the one in the place where we are now sitting, Brooklyn happens to be a Dutch name, but most of the names, Manhattan and so on, are Native American names. This is a settler colonial project. It's produced a national entity. The Israeli settler colonial project has produced an Israeli national entity, but it starts as a settler colonial project, taking away land and taking away control of the land from the indigenous population. And I'm trying to show that. And as in every settler colonial project, inevitably, necessarily, taking people's land away, taking away their rights, produces resistance. And that's what you see. What's coded by the settler as banditry or criminality or terrorism is actually the resistance of the indigenous population to an attempt to take their land, take their country, take their rights. So that's what's encompassed in the title.
In terms of the date and talking about, you know, that this was happening, this project had started, or at least that the Zionist project had started before 1917. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, as a historian who knows so much about this, could you give us just a little bit of that background of the beginnings of Zionism? And also maybe we could make this connection to Christian Zionism.
Right. Yeah, modern political Zionism is supposed to have started with the first Zionist Congress in 1897 in Basel, in Switzerland. And Herzl, who is the motivating leader and the thinker and the ideologue of early Zionism, is triggered by covering the trial of Captain Dreyfus, the Dreyfus Affair in Paris. He's an assimilated Jewish citizen of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He's sent by his newspaper to cover the Dreyfus trial, and he comes to the realization, or the belief, that it's impossible for Jews to live in this profoundly anti-Semitic European context. And that's what the Zionist idea grows out of. But those developments in the 1890s, the development, in other words, of modern political Zionism, are preceded by something that happens in the church in Protestant countries, in particular in England, which is part of a religious revival that involves a rereading of the Bible and a belief that is a bounden Christian duty to return the Jewish people to the Holy Land. And so you have powerful and influential British politicians like Lord Shaftesbury and his son-in-law, Lord Palmerston, who do everything possible to shift British policy towards support of this. Palmerston fights wars in the Middle East. Palmerston establishes the first British consulate in Jerusalem. Palmerston and Lord Shaftesbury and others established the Palestine Exploration Fund to do research on Palestine. And all of this is directed to British control of Palestine, ultimately, and directed also to the return, as they see it, of the Jewish people. So long before you have modern political Zionism as an important trend among Jewish communities in Eastern Europe and elsewhere in Europe, you have this Christian Zionism that develops mainly in Protestant countries and starting in England. It's also powerful in the United States, actually. And that's the background to the support for Zionism in Britain and in other Protestant countries. Another source of support, it has to be said, is anti-Semitism.
Yes.
The same Lord Balfour, who as Foreign Secretary in 1917 issues the Balfour Declaration on behalf of the British cabinet, was the prime minister a few years before who was responsible for the passing of the Alien Exclusion Act, which kept Jewish refugees from pogroms in Tsarist Russia from coming to England. Mm-hmm. It's the most anti-Semitic act since Edward I in British history. And so the same man who as prime minister was responsible for the Alien Exclusion Act is the man who's responsible for the Balfour Declaration. There are many other motivations for British support for Zionism, the main ones being strategic. The British wanted to control Palestine, and they wanted to control it long before the Balfour Declaration, and they chose Zionism as their vehicle, but the aim was a strategic one from the beginning with the British.
So we have Zionism, both Christian Zionism and Jewish Zionism, and then we have colonial settlerism. And we see those two things working together.
Right.
To then create the state of Israel, which in the creation of that state is also trying to erase an entire people who are already living there.
Right.
And so that erasure, that displacement, that taking over of the culture or trying to wipe it out or appropriate it, all of those things are things that I saw in last April when I was in Palestine and then this January as well.
Right.
And I feel like we saw this, like the playing out of this project of displacement. And we heard directly from Palestinians who were saying, both Christian and Muslim, we are being pushed out, we're being displaced, and it's a numbers game. Mm-hmm. They talked a lot about the numbers game in East Jerusalem, and also in, I mean, we specifically went to Sheikh Jarrah, we went to Silwan, we saw a home that had been demolished, and a couple who's living there in a little caravan next to the rubble of their home. Then just recently, a further 19 families were their homes were stolen from them, and they were kicked out and left with nowhere to live except to find someone to take them in, relatives. And we saw that happening in Sheikh Jarrah also, and also in the small villages. Mm-hmm. We were in this a couple of different villages where one that's just got pushed out because of an archaeological site.
Right.
This is the village Nabi Samuel.
Nabi Samuel. Which is where the prophet Samuel is supposed to be buried.
Right, but I think that's even dubious evidence that he actually was
like, if you believe that stuff, I have a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. I mean, most of those prophets' resting places.
So one of the things that we learned was about the demolition orders and the displacement, the act of displacement that's happening and the way that the demolition orders are being issued and how many of them are. We spoke with a couple who had Eid and Nawal, and they said they have had, like, you know, 20 plus at a time demolition orders against them and their village, in the village that they're in. And it's down, it's up on a ridge, and it's down a dead end road, and there's a checkpoint at the entrance to the road. So they cannot come and go from the village without going through a checkpoint. From the time I was there last April to the time we went back in January, they have been issued electronic ID cards. So it looks a little bit like a credit card with a chip in it, and they are not allowed to cross that border without that electronic chip being read to know their whereabouts at all times. There's cameras all around looking at everyone in the village all the time. So if a pen for animals is repaired, a demolition order is issued. If an old structure, like the shed, falls down or part of the wall is destroyed, they're not allowed to fix it. If they fix it, they get a demolition order. So speaking with them and just hearing it, the reality really came home of this very extreme, extreme oppression and apartheid and just trying to get rid of them, trying to make them so unhappy. The power goes out for long times. Every day, they can't bring in very many fresh fruits and vegetables. If they have too many, they have to spread them out amongst the community so people can bring them across a little bit at a time. The children can't leave to go to high school without crossing checkpoints, which is extremely dangerous. So they're very fearful always to allow the children to go and get an education. They started an elementary school just to educate the children themselves. But beyond that, if they leave, they can be detained, tortured, or killed on the way back. And they showed us pictures of the injuries on the backs of their son who had been just detained crossing a checkpoint coming home. But something also that really impacted me was hearing them say, we never know when the demolition will happen. So what we're doing is just waiting and trying to bide our time and figure, do we destroy our home ourselves so that they don't do it and then charge us for the destruction? Because what happens is when they will get paid, even one of the bills that someone received from an Israeli demolition of someone's home had, like, the sandwiches that the soldiers ate that day were part of the bill that they then, the Palestinians, had to pay for having their home destroyed.
Yeah.
So this is obviously ongoing, and also we heard so many stories of how much more it has intensified.
Yeah.
Since October 7th and even recent months. Yeah.
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 Well, I mean, two things. I was there in December, just before you were there, and the state of Jerusalem itself is awful. It's absolutely appalling. Because, go back to the history, this is an attempt to turn an overwhelmingly Arab country into a Jewish state. That was the title of Herzl's famous book, Der Judenstaat, the state of the Jews. And that was always the objective of Zionism. The objective of Zionism was not to come to Palestine and live with the Palestinians. It was to transform Palestine from an Arab country into a Jewish country. And Herzl, in his diary, said, we will try and spirit the penniless population across the frontiers. Mm-hmm. And Ben-Gurion talks about transferring the Palestinians in his diaries, in other words, expelling them. So this has always been the motivation and you mentioned the calculation of numbers. The demographic game mm-hmm. has always been in the minds of both Zionists and Palestinians. Mm-hmm. How many Jews, how many Arabs, how many Arabs, how many Jews? Mm-hmm. How has the population changed over time? Interestingly, in the whole of Palestine, between the river and the sea, the Arab population is still slightly larger mm-hmm. than the Jewish population, in spite of over a century of trying to spirit them across or expel them or terrorize them or squeeze them in the way that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. The Palestinian population is still slightly larger than the Israeli Jewish population. And that's why you have these kinds of horrific but very subtle means of pressure mm-hmm. on the population in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. In Gaza, it's overt. I mean, the destruction of anything that would make Gaza livable, the intentional destruction mm-hmm. of 9 hospitals and the damage to the other 25, the intentional destruction of every single university in Gaza, mm-hmm. the destruction of the sewage plants, the destruction of water treatment plants, the destruction of literally everything that makes the Gaza Strip livable was intended for the same purpose that Herzl was writing about and that Ben-Gurion was writing about. You transform an overwhelmingly Arab country into an overwhelmingly Jewish country. And the details that you're talking about have actually gotten much, much worse since the attack of Hamas on the settlements and the army bases around the Gaza Strip on October 7, 2023. Ever since that has happened, Israel has acted with much greater ferocity, especially obviously in Gaza, but also in Lebanon and also in the West Bank, and also to some extent in Syria. And they are being permitted to do this and are armed and are financed in doing this by us, my taxes or your taxes, our taxes, to the tune of tens of billions of dollars already. Have gone to pay for the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, to pay for these procedures that you're talking about in the West Bank, to pay for the demolition of large parts of today of South Lebanon. And it's not just money. Every single fighter aircraft in the Israeli Air Force is American. Every single combat helicopter is American. Most of the engines of the tanks are either German or American. So we are paying for, and we are arming, and we are providing vetoes at the Security Council to allow the continuation of all of these things that we're talking about. And I think that's the thing that we as Americans should be concerned about. What's happening over there should concern us as human beings. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it is being done by our government, I mean, that's one of the arguments I make here. Some of these wars are not Israeli wars. They're Israeli-American wars, 1982 war. Sharon went to Washington, told Secretary of State Haig what he was going to do in May 1982, and Haig said, fine, do it. And the United States paid for it. And the United States prevented a ceasefire for months while Israel demolished Beirut and besieged it. And this is what's happened over the past 2.5 years since October 7th. So I think that that's what should concern us, I think, in particular as Americans. As human beings, we should be concerned anyway. Mm-hmm. But as American citizens mm-hmm. who pay for this and whose government is doing this in our name, it's a mark of shame, in my view, on all of us as Americans.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is The 100 Years War on Palestine, an afternoon with Rashid Khalidi. Professor Khalidi is a Palestinian-American historian of the Middle East and the Edward Said Professor Emeritus of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. The talk is a conversation between Professor Khalidi and Reverend Megan Henry from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Shelter Rock, followed by a Q&A session.
One of the things that people have asked me since coming back is, like, what did people say to you? What did the Palestinians say to you, like, to us as Americans who were there, about, like, what we can do? What do they want us to do? And I heard over and over, learn about us, understand who we are, learn about our culture, teach others about us. We exist. We are here. We have a long history of a very rich, long history of a culture that is being attempted to be erased. So it was like, come and see, come and get to know us, and then go back and tell people about us. And also do anything you can to affect policy in your government. So that's, you know, elections, it's, you know, writing the letters, making the calls, going and lobbying in DC, do anything that we can, because it is our, if you're paying taxes here, then this is our money that is doing this. So we have a responsibility, if we care about this as US citizens, to try to do something to change it.
I think the first thing you said is in some ways the most important.
Yeah.
You know, the Zionist Project was very successful for many reasons. One of the primary reasons is there is a connection between the Jewish people and the land. Mm-hmm. That's a legitimate and understandable religious connection. Mm-hmm. The second reason is that what Herzl perceived in Paris and what he lived in Vienna, which had a virulently anti-Semitic mayor at the time, mm-hmm. a man named Karl Loiger, mm-hmm. those are realities that drove people to Zionism. It wasn't that they said, we want to go and take somebody else's land. It's that we can't live here because we are being persecuted. This was a time of pogroms in the mm-hmm. Russian Empire. So it wasn't just anti-Semitism in France or anti-Semitism in Austro-Hungary. It was people being burned out of their homes and killed all over the Russian Empire at the beginning of the 20th century. And that all comes to a culmination in the Holocaust. So this is a reason that people turned to Zionism, an understandable reason that people turned to Zionism. The point, though, is this was intended for perfectly understandable reasons, but it was successful not only because people understood all of that, but because this was a financially successful movement which managed to raise a lot of money, mm-hmm. and because it had a wonderful narrative, a narrative that went back to the Bible, mm-hmm. that fed into Christian Zionism, mm-hmm. that created a bunch of myths making the desert bloom. Most of the oranges exported from Palestine were grown by Palestinian farmers for most of the entire period up to 1948. It wasn't Israel that made the desert bloom. To the extent to which it bloomed, it was blooming because there were people cultivating the land since time immemorial.
And in fact, many times currently is the Israelis are putting in non-indigenous plants that actually that either are invasive or don't grow well there, or I mean, there's a blooming that already is there,
right.
But they're Europeanizing also, like the settlements and with architecture and plants. And
so where I was going with this is that this is a project that's successful for many reasons. One of the reasons is this has a great story. And that story completely dominated the understanding of Palestine and Israel for generations and generations and generations. Mm-hmm. It was well told, it was well fashioned, it was beautifully crafted. You had movies like Exodus. Anybody who's older than 50 or 60 here will probably know that that was an enormously influential book and film. Paul Newman, Academy Award winning film. I think many people believe everything that was in that movie, and that was part of a successful narrative. So what people are saying is, please understand, learn, read, that there is a different narrative. Yeah. And that was not accessible 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. There was nobody who told that story. Today it is accessible, mm-hmm. and there's no excuse for not learning or trying to learn a better and more nuanced and more honest story, mm-hmm. and a different narrative, which is the Palestinian narrative. I mean, it's one of the things I try and do in this book, but one of the things that heartens me is that for the first time in my lifetime, I'm 77, but you have mainstream publishers publishing books on Palestine by the dozens.
Yeah.
And so the books are there. The films are there. Now, the distributors won't let you see them in mainstream theaters, but the films are there. There's a half dozen films right now out, documentaries and long metrage, regular films, that are out in cinemas if you can find them, or that can be screened via Netflix or something else. So the stuff is there for the first time. And I think that they're right, the people who talk to you, in saying the most important thing is to educate yourselves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Educate yourselves and teach others. And I think the Angelica Theater in Manhattan has been showing a lot of Palestinian films. Yeah. So in terms of thinking about settler colonialism and the U.S. kind of role in this and Christian nationalism and Zionism, something somebody said to me, I'm trying to remember the exact story, but it was like when we were in Umm al-Qair, in the village, the man who was talking to us, so they're right next to a settlement which has been put in next to the village, and they've put in caravan, the settlers have put in some caravans right at the border, and they put a new road through the village, which incidentally, the settlers are driving on this road at very high speeds. And you may have heard recently about the 5-year-old girl who was hit by one of the settlers flying through that road. Now, she was hospitalized. She is okay. But it's so this is where what they are living in this situation. And he said that he was out and he met a shepherd, and it was one of the settlers, and they actually sat down and talked a little bit.
That's unusual.
Yeah. And he said that he even said to the settler, you know, you have these Christian Zionists are on your side right now, but they will not be on your side forever. And this is something you need to think about. Who are your allies and what will be the future? And I just thought that was really interesting to think about, like, why?
What was the settler's reaction?
He said he looked a little like he got quiet. It made him think about this, and he seemed kind of like, I don't want to think about this. But it was like a shocking kind of like, because we've already started to see Christians, nationalists, and Zionists in this country starting to turn against
Israel.
Right. And then I remember from something that I learned from when I was in a very evangelical Christian community, they were talking about this back in the late 80s, Zionism. But it was in order for the second coming of Jesus. Right. So populate this land with the Jews so that Jesus will come. And they didn't care at all about the Jewish people. And there were actually, these people that I was speaking with were actually quite anti-Semitic. So what is this, like, where do we see this going? It just feels like there's been such, it's been such an intense time with so many things happening and all of these different reactions and coalitions and breaking up of coalitions. And I just wonder where could this possibly be going?
I mean, I'm a historian. I can't tell you where things are going to end
up. Right.
I can tell you maybe how we got to where we are.
Yeah.
And one of the things that brought us to where we are is that people, especially younger people, have watched a live stream genocide for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And they saw through that everything that the mainstream media and their politicians was telling them was a disgusting lie, that they had been sold a bill of goods, that none of this that they had been taught about Israel or they had learned about Israel was really true. Mm-hmm. And the true face of what was being done was apparent to them by watching on their devices through non-mainstream media, alternative media, independent media, social media, people whom they came to trust. Young people in Gaza who, at the risk of their lives, 240 journalists were murdered intentionally by Israel for broadcasting the truth about Gaza. And that's what young people were seeing. Now, for those of you who read the New York Times or watch CNN, this may have escaped your notice that that was what was happening. But anybody who got their news essentially through a device like this knew better, and they saw a reality. I mean, they saw that 75,000 at least people were killed, of whom at least 4/5 or 5/6 were civilians. 10, 12, 15,000 children, not combatants. A majority of those killed are women and children, non-combatants, or old people, non-combatants, and many of the men, non-combatant. And young people saw that. And that has shifted the discourse in the United States, the public discourse, not the political discourse, and not the media discourse. I picked up for my sins, I've been reading the New York Times since I was a kid. I can't help it. I was born in New York, I read the thing, I can't help it. My children hold it against me, and my grandchildren. And I was reading a piece today on the attempted murder of a Palestinian activist.
Yes.
There were 3 paragraphs in that New York Times article written by 3 different reporters about how the person who tried to do this was a member of the Jewish Defense League or a Jewish Defense League offshoot, something about the background of them, of that organization, and that he was going to flee to Israel after throwing Molotov cocktails into her home. Three paragraphs. There were six paragraphs talking about how Nardine Kisweni was a terrible person and the group is accused of anti-Semitism. So that the victim was victimized in six paragraphs of the New York Times article, and the perpetrator of an attempted terrorist act had his group and his actions described in three paragraphs. Mm-hmm. That's the New York Times. Everything is seen from a certain perspective, and none of the rest of the mainstream media are any better most of the time. There are a few good journalists, there are some good presenters on TV, but essentially what most people through the mainstream media see is a very filtered, curated, limited segment of reality. That's not what young people see. I used to be able to mention the New York Times in a classroom, and a third or a quarter of the students would have read the article I was talking about. Never, never today do I get a reaction if I mention something in any of the mainstream media. And that's caused an earth-shaking shift in the public. Now, our politicians are way behind, and the billionaires who own the mainstream media aren't going to change their views. Mm-hmm. And they will tell CNN, and they will tell as soon as the Ellisons take it over. And they are telling CBS, and they are telling the Washington Post, or the LA Times, or the New York Times, what to write and what not to write. There's a book coming out in April or May called The Complicit Lens, which is a study of the media and the Gaza War. And it just takes apart the way in which the Gaza War was completely distorted in the mainstream media, especially the New York Times. So things are changing. Now, where is that going to go? I don't know.
I have tried to absorb as much of the alternative news media that I can. And I know that sometimes I'm getting things. I mean, I think there is a large amount of critical thinking and like research that each one of us needs to do when we're absorbing media. Right. There's so many different outlets now, and there's some really great ones.
And some very bad ones.
And some people I talk to are like, I don't know what to trust. Yeah. I don't know is this made up? Did this really happen? I have no idea. Even if there's a video of it, I have no idea. And I think that with what's happening in the educational system here in the U.S., also with a move away from thinking critically, move away from using your own mind to understand and make distinctions between different things, that is could create a real problem for us into the future of like knowing what is real and what's not real and how to learn things, how to find out what's happening.
I mean, I think it goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago, which is that you have to educate yourself so you can distinguish. Mm-hmm. And that's not an easy job. I mean, I'm an educator. I've been studying some of these things all my life. I'm discovering new things every time I do research or writing. So, you know, there's no end to the amount of things that one has to try and, you know, master. But if you believe that this is an issue that concerns us as a country and us as human beings, then I think there's an obligation to try and do your best to learn these things in order, for example, to discriminate between bad and good alternative media. Mm-hmm. There's some really bad stuff out there, terrible propaganda on every side. I'm not just talking about the mainstream media, all media. And you have to know a little bit to be able to distinguish what's likely to be good and what's not so good. Mm-hmm. But the change is definitely happening. And it's happening not just among young people. I'm impressed by, and not just among people who are progressive or, you know, lean in a certain political direction. It's clearly also happening among more conservative people. It's clearly happening among independents. It's clearly happening even among older people who tend to have, you know, firmer beliefs about this topic. Mm-hmm. And I find that very encouraging, but I have yet to see that translated into political change. We have a few members of Congress, we have a few politicians, but a very few who are taking a moral stand on these issues about aid to Israel or about human rights or about the killing of American citizens who happen to be Palestinians or many other issues. Mm-hmm. But they're a small minority, and that has to change. Or we will not. We will continue to be complicit in war crimes and genocide, which is the situation today.
It's so frustrating watching the politicians and listening to them. Like, I think Bernie maybe finally said the word genocide or something like that. I mean, also Gavin Newsom, you know, uttered the word apartheid and then is rolling it right back right now saying. So it's really feels so slow and frustrating when people's lives are at stake.
But we can put their feet to the fire.
Yeah.
I mean, we all have Congress people and senators. And those people, when they hear from us, they pay attention. Sooner or later, they have to pay attention. Mm-hmm. The money counts, but the votes also count. And we can put Gavin, I'm not a California resident, but California residents can put Newsom's feet to the fire. We can put Senator Gillibrand's feet to the fire. We can put Schumer's feet to the fire. Mm-hmm. You can all put your congressman or congresswoman's feet to the fire. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an obligation that we have. Learn about the issues. And look at what's coming up in Congress and weigh in on those things. Mm-hmm. It seems like a minuscule thing to make a phone call or send a letter, but if enough people do it, they actually do pay. They have to pay attention, mm-hmm. especially people in the House of Representatives, because they're up every 2 years.
Yeah.
And they're being primaried. And most of us live in, or many of us may live in, overwhelmingly Democratic districts. Mm-hmm. It used to be the case that any old half-asleep Democratic politician could stay in a House seat forever. Mm-hmm. That's no longer the case. Mm-hmm. People are pushing them within the party and primarying them if they don't take the right stand on issues that are important to voters. And so we have more power than we did when the old machine used to control everything. And I lived in Chicago for many years, and I've lived in New York for many years. There are machines that run every political party, especially in this city and in Chicago, the cities I've lived in.
That's actually pretty hopeful to hear you say that, because sometimes I feel like it's just not even worth it, like not even worth trying with them.
I mean, it's not the only thing to do.
Yeah, there's so many.
There's so many other things to do, yeah. But it's one thing that's easy to do. Mm-hmm. And it's our responsibility. I mean, if this is to the extent to which we live in a democracy, mm-hmm. I think we live in a plutocracy, but we do have a democracy somewhere underneath that. The billionaires maybe are more powerful than the people, but the people are there too.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is The 100 Years War on Palestine, an afternoon with Rashid Khalidi. Professor Khalidi is a Palestinian-American historian of the Middle East and the Edward Said Professor Emeritus of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. The talk is a conversation between Professor Khalidi and Reverend Megan Henry from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Shelter Rock, followed by a Q&A session.
What would you say about these institutions that have had such a hard time speaking with moral clarity on Palestine, especially just over these past
I'm glad you asked me that question. I think that it is especially the role of moral and spiritual and religious institutions mm-hmm. to take the lead. These are not only or mainly political issues. These are also moral issues and spiritual issues. I mean, people are being slaughtered, and people are being starved, and people are being deprived of medical care, intentionally, purposely, and with our tax dollars supporting it. Now, that's not only true in Palestine. There are other horrible places on earth where sometimes the United States is not the main actor. And we should be concerned about those things as well. But this is a case where we are, in some sense, the main actor. The entire military budget of the Israeli army over the past 2.5 years was paid for by us, almost $30 billion. We paid for everything that was done. And that's a moral, it's not just a political, it's a moral issue. Mm-hmm. And I'm disappointed that so few churches and synagogues and other houses of, you know, of worship and so few clergy and clerical institutions have come out on this issue. It seems to me an American moral issue, just like immigration or gender or any other issue that we should be concerned about. Mm-hmm. This is a moral issue. It's not just a political issue. And it's the people who are, in my view, doing the wrong thing on those issues claim that they're doing it for moral reasons. We are keeping immigrants out, or we're ending woke whatever, or we're oppressing transgender people for moral reasons. Well, I think there's a moral argument to be made on the other side, and that's true about Palestine, and a religious argument. I mean, there are Christians. The Roman Catholic Archbishop was not allowed to go to the Holy Sepulchre on Palm Sunday.
That's right. That happened just
this morning.
Yep.
And I'm not saying that's, you know, the most important thing that's happened in Palestine in the last 24 hours, but it's the kind of thing that I think moral institutions, not just churches and synagogues and so forth, but anybody who claims any kind of moral authority, it's true of universities, it should be true of other institutions. They should sometimes, in my view, take a stand on some of these things, or at least not be craven cowards and cave in to pressure not to allow talk about Palestine. And so in universities, in art galleries, in museums, you have, in many cases, the most cowardly response. So the British Museum is taking down the name Palestine from some of its exhibits. We have nothing to do with the British Museum. That's over in London. Mm-hmm. But it's an example of cultural institutions, mm-hmm. which maybe you don't expect to take a public moral stand, but they at least should be able to resist pressure on them to take a certain position or to not take a certain position.
Yeah. I know my own religious institution organization was tepid and slow to respond after the response, the Israeli response after October 7th. And I think Unitarian Universalism has been grappling with the question of Palestine for a long time and has recently become more, had a more clear call for justice and freedom for Palestinians. And the group that I took in January actually was all Unitarian Universalist seminarians and ministers mm-hmm. and a few other folks who are religious professionals working in the UU field, 12 of them. And it's just rippled out with so many. They came back and have given sermons and given presentations.
Right.
And, you know, we're working on a book of reflections from it. And it's just amazing how that dozen people, the impact that they have been able to make
right.
On the institution.
Two things. The Unitarian Universalist Church has been really, generally speaking, good on this issue.
Yeah.
I've spoken twice
yeah.
to the assembly. So
yeah.
I mean, the fact that they invited me way back when, even there was a time before...
Before 2007?
Yes, that's
okay.
The second time
I've
addressed.
Yeah.
Once was in, I think, California.
Okay.
I don't remember. It's a long time ago. But the second thing you said is really important. To the extent to which people can go and actually see, the scales will drop from your eyes. Mm-hmm. You just have to walk through Hebron.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to walk across any of these enormous cattle pen checkpoints mm-hmm. that control movement of Palestinians, but not Israelis,
mm-hmm.
to understand. You just have to see those things, and that's it. You know more than the average American who has been systematically lied to by the New York Times and CNN.
Yeah.
Just going, and so sending delegations, mm-hmm. is really, to my way of thinking, the best way, especially delegations of people like pastors
yeah.
or educators, whatever it may be.
Anyone who has a voice or a community where they have a voice where you can share
yeah.
What you witnessed and experienced. Yeah.
Precisely.
Yeah.
The book talks a lot about failures of Palestinian leadership at different periods in the past. I talk about the failures of the leadership in the 20s and the 30s, for example. Right up to 1948. They were universally seen by Palestinians, by the way, to have failed. And that whole leadership disappears after 1948. They have almost no influence from that point onwards. And I talk a lot about what I see as the failures of the leadership that led up to and signed the Oslo Accords of 1993, which were a disaster for the Palestinian people. And I'm able to say that because I was involved in the negotiations that preceded Oslo as an advisor to the Palestinian delegation that negotiated for 2.5 years with an Israeli delegation, mainly in Washington, started in Madrid and mainly was in Washington. I mean, I could go into that at length. It's a painful subject because what we were offered in Washington was essentially a continuation of colonization and settlement, a maintenance of occupation and Israeli security control, and a sealing of autonomy under that. And that was simply nowhere near the minimal aspirations of the Palestinian people. And so, to its credit, the delegation in Washington wouldn't accept that deal. And that was what the United States and Israel had agreed upon beforehand. This goes way back. that American imposed, Israeli imposed ceiling. And the PLO leadership accepted it at Oslo. And that's how we ended up in the terrible situation we are today. And the Palestinians today have a real leadership problem. Division, incoherence, a lack of strategic clarity. I could go on and on and on. And it's a problem the Palestinians have to solve themselves. As far as the student movement and the solidarity movement generally, I wouldn't picture it as a failure. I think it was a world historical effort that brought about massive change in public opinion. Now, why was it not more successful? Because you have these power structures. I mean, I was involved in opposing the Vietnam War back in the 60s. It took 15 years to stop the Vietnam War. And the movement then was enormous. It represented an overwhelming majority of Americans. And it was not just fueled by student activists. It was a huge movement, churches and unions and the civil rights movement, all Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., everybody was directed to stopping that war. And it continued from the early 60s until 1975. So to expect that a student movement could stop something that's as deeply rooted as this American-Israeli connection goes back to Woodrow Wilson, for heaven's sakes, is it to be a bit naive. We have to understand that you have to build a movement over many years, and you have to deal with these power structures. I mean, the military-industrial complex is making a fortune out of this. Mm-hmm. These are not people to be dismissed. Mm-hmm. The oil industry. You know, people say, oh, the Zionist lobby, the Israel lobby. Yeah, sure. But there's a lot of other interests involved in this war that have nothing to do with Zionism or Israel or Jews or Palestine, for that matter. They're just making money. And they are very powerful. AIPAC is powerful. You think the oil industry is not powerful? You think that Raytheon and McDonnell Douglas and all those folks, they're infinitely powerful. And so changing this would require more than what I think was an enormously successful movement of solidarity. And then you mentioned it yourself in your question, then there's the repression that they brought down. I'm retired from Columbia, but the repression that students still there and that my colleagues are facing is indescribable because it involves such complex bureaucratic procedures. We want to have an event. You can't have it here. We have security conditions. Move it to there. No, you can't have it. Only CUID, Columbia University ID. And by the end of the day, I know you can't have it. And they will run you around 57 circles. Whereas the other day, two Israeli reservists who are students spoke about their service in Gaza to a large audience, no problem. They were allowed to have one of the biggest auditoriums on campus. Mm. Now, when you're dealing with that kind of thing, it's a little hard to have a movement. So the students, to do things, for example, at some university, they have to move out off campus to do it. So the other side has upped its game. And it's not easy to respond to that quickly. And this is going to be a long-term thing. This is not going to happen in 3 months or 3 years. It's going to take a little while to change. The second question about the Arab states, that's a really important question. Let me start by talking about Arab peoples. There's a poll every year of Arab public opinion in, I think, 13 or 14 Arab countries, right across the Arab world. Arab public opinion is uniformly supportive of the Palestinians. Now, most of those people live in undemocratic, authoritarian regimes which don't pay any attention to public opinion. I mean, we have leaders in this country who are obliged to some extent not just to pay attention to the people who finance their campaigns, but to voters. Now, the president of Egypt and the king of Saudi Arabia and the king of Morocco, and I could go on and on and on and on and on, are not accountable to anybody. And they do what they think is in the interest of their pocketbook, of their maintenance in power, and of their connection to the United States, because they're all connected to the United States. And five or six of them have diplomatic relations with Israel. Morocco, the Emirates, Bahrain, Egypt, Jordan. Sudan doesn't have diplomatic relations, but they agreed to have. Did I miss the Emirates? There's six of them. Anyway, so those are countries that didn't even break relations with Israel while Israel was slaughtering Palestinians by the thousands. Those are not regimes that are responsive to the public opinion that every single year says, we see Israel as a major threat, we support the Palestinians. So, and this is not a problem of 2026. This is a problem that goes back to the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, when these were countries that were still basically under the thumb of British or French control. So Jordan was nominally independent. A cousin of mine was asked to become a tutor to one of the princes, and he was being driven around by a British officer. And he said, "Now, wait a minute, between the palace and the British embassy, there's a gate there." They said, "Yeah, the British ambassador can walk into the palace from the back door and basically tell the king what to do." And he said, "I don't want this job." And they drove him right to the airport. But that's still the case in many Arab countries. The American ambassador is more powerful than the president. So the Arab countries have been a terrible disappointment. They have failed their own people. They've certainly failed the Palestinians. And they're beholden to interests that have very little to do, in my view, with the interests of their own people. The last question, which is about Palestinian resistance. I mean, there are many forms of resistance. One of the things that I'm researching right now is a connection between Ireland and Palestine in a particular fashion. It's a book I'm working on about British counterinsurgency as it was used in Ireland during their War of Independence and then in Palestine in the 30s, and how it was then basically bequeathed to the Israelis. The Israeli military is basically the stepchild of the British counterinsurgency. And one of the things that struck me about the Irish in their War of Independence was the degree to which, in addition to armed resistance, which they were very, very good at, they were doing all kinds of other things. They were engaged in a kind of resistance that involved legitimacy. So the elected members of the Westminster Parliament in the 1918 election, all of them left London and went to Ireland and constituted themselves the Dáil, the Irish Parliament. And they said, "We represent the people of Ireland, we're declaring a republic." And this was a form that gave a legitimacy to what the people who were shooting and setting off bombs and so on and so forth were doing. And it gave them a structure of governance over the parts of Ireland that could be liberated from the British during the course of the War of Independence, which was as important as what Michael Collins and the intelligence and the military people were doing. At the same time, they were doing propaganda in this country. They won over Irish Americans. They won over ordinary Americans. The pressure that the United States put on Great Britain in 1919, 20, 21 was one of the major reasons the Irish won. They did not win in the field. They had to be in the field. They had to be attacking British patrols and killing British intelligence agents, or they wouldn't have won. But they wouldn't have won if Eamon de Valera was not in the United States raising money and doing propaganda for the Irish cause. They were doing the same thing in England, by the way, with the Irish community in England. So, I mean, those are all forms of resistance. Staying on your land is a form of resistance. There are multiple forms of resistance. Boycott, which is an Irish tactic, developed in the 1880s during the land war, is an enormously powerful form of resistance. So the boycott, sanctions and divestment movement is the great-great-grandchild of what the Irish started in the 1880s, and the Indians picked it up and the South Africans picked it up.
Yeah.
Those are all forms of resistance. And so a lot of people, they think, oh, resistance has to be armed resistance. Well, there are multiple forms of resistance. And in fact, you're not going to win if you only do one. If you only boycott or you only do the parliamentary thing or the propaganda, you'll lose. Every successful national liberation movement, the South Africans, the Algerians, the Irish, the Vietnamese, they have all used multiple forms of resistance. Let me start with the difficult conversations question. I have had difficult conversations all my life. I mean, I grew up in New York City. I think that explains it. And I guess the two things that I would say is the first thing to do is absolutely you have to keep your cool. You are being told outrageous things by people who are deep believers in a myth or a fantasy or a partial lie. And it's hard to maintain your patience and your control when you're listening to absolute nonsense. That's the first thing. The second thing is you really have to know your stuff. If you're going to argue with somebody who has a fully developed argument and thinks they know about the topic, which many of the people you're probably likely to be interacting with will, you have to be sure that you know what you're talking about. The last thing is have a few recommendations for them. Say, look, you don't agree with me? Read this. And if you have any intention of changing your mind, if you want to stay where you are, then why are we talking? But if you want to see my point of view, don't just listen to me. Look at this movie, see this YouTube video, whatever it may be, a book, whatever, an article, an author. Mm-hmm. Have a suggestion. Now, that's not easy because they come at you from different directions when you're talking with people. But those would be my recommendations. Iran. Okay, this is a whole separate topic. As I understood it, the question was about the Iranian conditions that have been issued by Iran for ending this war. I honestly don't think that the condition having to do with the removal of American bases from the Middle East is very likely to be fulfilled. I would guess these are the beginning of a bargaining session, which, if it ever takes place, would start with maximal demands. And these are maximal demands. The reparations, Iranian control of the Straits of Hormuz, removal of American bases, a halt to Israeli attacks in Palestine and in Lebanon. I think maybe some of those might be achievable. Maybe some new regime for the Straits may be achievable. Possibly stopping Israeli attacks might be achievable. Ending the assassinations, I mean, there are some of those things which I have difficulty seeing this administration doing, but I have difficulty seeing the American conditions achieved as well. So I don't think the two sides are anywhere near an agreement. I hope and pray that there will be one. I hope and pray that American forces are not engaged in a land war in Iran. There's no way for the United States to win a war with Iran. I know this from talking to people within the military, some of whom were tasked with trying to determine this. It is clear. The U.S. Naval Institute just published something yesterday which said the same thing that I have known from talking to people in the military. A war with Iran is not something. I mean, it didn't go so well in Vietnam, didn't go so well in Iraq, didn't go so well in Afghanistan. This will be just as bad or worse. Iran is going to look more like Gallipoli, for those of you who know it. I think this has the potential for being one of the most dangerous conflicts of this century, if it's not stopped very soon. And I don't see it stopping, unfortunately. I really hope I'm wrong.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was The 100 Years War on Palestine, an afternoon with Rashid Khalidi. Professor Khalidi is a Palestinian-American historian of the Middle East and the Edward Said Professor Emeritus of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. The event was recorded on March 29, 2026 at the First Unitarian Congregational Society of Brooklyn and was co-sponsored by First Unitarian Brooklyn's chapter of Unitarian Universalists for Justice in the Middle East, New York City DSA Anti-War Working Group, and Brooklyn for Peace. The talk was a conversation between Professor Khalidi and Reverend Megan Henry from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Shelter Rock, followed by a Q&A session. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.